Well, when you're doing your spring maintenance and cleanup, don't forget about your car. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Jim Ward back in the studio with me today. He's service manager at Smart Motors of Toyota and Madison. Has over 10 years of master certification. He comes by every other month to talk about your vehicle questions. And so I hope you'll join in. Give us a call with your maintenance question at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Ari. It's great to be here.
Well, spring is a good time, apparently, to do an annual kind of spring cleanup on your car.
It is. I mean, you know, winter is harsh. Is harsh. And the last couple of them we've had have just seemed to be particularly brutal. Lots of snow, which means lots of salt. And our cars just get exposed to some extremely harsh conditions. This is the time to clean it up.
So, obviously, salt, it can do a lot of harm. And it gets underneath the car, and so if you're just washing with a hose or something, you're not going to get to it.
You know, cars are obviously made to look at from the top side, you know, to be pretty from the top side. Everything's painted, everything's coated. But honestly, even coated surfaces, chrome that's used on various parts of the exterior of the car is really meant to be coated with something and protected. You go a couple of years in this climate with chrome, you know, lug nuts, the wheels, the various wheel covers, some of them have chrome on them, and those things will start to pit with some orange rust, which can, you know, a little abrasive wax, it'll come right off, but they do need to be protected. But on the underside of the car, there are a lot of components, your steering and suspension, knuckles and linkages, the exhaust system. There are lots of components under there which are not painted and can't be painted. You know, parts of your brake system, because of how they have to work, they can't really have a coating like that on them. And so those, they are designed to not rust out like the sheet metal, perhaps, of a car if it gets stripped down to metal and exposed to salt. But it long term, it does have an effect on them. It does cause things to hang up. It can cause lots of problems with brake systems and anything else that has to move underneath that car, move back and forth. So flushing it really well underneath the car is really important this time of year to get all that accumulated salt that we picked up all winter long out of there.
What about inside? I mean, we get, you know, you get salt on the floor.
Sure.
And
sure. Most cars that have been in Wisconsin 5 to 10 years have a left footprint, you know, in the driver's seat, that spot there that carried all the salt. There are lots of products made to do that. I like to keep things simple. I mean, really just a quarter teaspoon of baking soda, a couple of tablespoons of vinegar, and a few cups of warm water. And again, you can play with this. You don't have to have an exact recipe for that. But
right. But
about that ratio of those components, and if you have a particularly, you know, gnarly thing to clean, you could throw in another quarter teaspoon of Castile powdered soap too, which just makes it clean a little bit better. Using that is going to leave a vinegar odor for a while. It'll dissipate, but you know, any cleaners you use, you know,
going to leave some odor.
Right, they'll leave some odors, and you know, the more sophisticated companies will put scents in there to make it smell kind of nice, but you're still likely breathing some, you know, compounds that you don't want to. So I try to keep it simple, organic when I clean that kind of stuff. And that generally will clean up the salt stains on the floor and on the carpet. You can use that. You can also use that on fabric seats. When it comes to leather, you want to be a little bit more careful. Leathers and cars, you want to test the spot in an inconspicuous place with whatever you're going to clean leather with and make sure it doesn't affect the appearance.
Filters? Do you look at filters this time of year?
Yep. You know, filters, air filter and cabin filter are the primary filters in the car. The oil filter isn't something that's so much of an inspection. It's changed basically every time the oil's changed. And you know, I kind of have become known for saying use manufacturer's recommendations. Do it when they say to do it. But that's an interesting area when it comes to air filters because in our experience at our shop, about 50% of the time, the filters are not dirty at the time that they're recommended. We inspect them. They're still clean. We don't replace them at that point. Yeah. That's something that it just varies by where you have to drive and what the driving conditions are. We replace them when they're dirty. You know, we look at the air filter. They should be looked at about every 6 months, so about twice a year, and that's true of the cabin filter as well. Obviously, the engine is designed to be – the engine gets varnish and build up inside from the gas and oil that's used, but you don't want to have things coming through the intake that can be abrasive, that can affect the engine. So that's the purpose of the engine air filter. The cabin filter – is supposed to collect pollens and various particulates in the air. If you have allergies, that's a real help for people who have allergies to have a cabin filter that picks that stuff up. But as importantly, cars have begun to develop over the last few years gym bag stink. I don't know what else to call it, but yeah. Inside of the ventilation box that your heater and air conditioner is housed in, if a cabin filter gets too dirty and more of those particulates start to come into that box, or if you don't have a cabin filter, those accumulate in there and they can start to develop mold and mildews and you start to get that odor. There are ways to clean that out without. It's an extensive job. I mean, I've just even on a simple little Corolla, it's about a 12-hour job to take that box out and replace it. So it's not something that you're going to take out and scrub by hand. But there are cleaners that are made to spray in from the top where your air comes into the ventilation system and spray up the bottom where water condensation drifts out through a hose and clean that out. But the cabin filter helps prevent the buildup of particulates that will lead to mildew and mold in that box. So it isn't just to protect what you breathe. Well, it is, but over long term, it could be a different condition when that builds up. And you can even get a charcoal activated cabin filter, so that if you live out in the country and you got to drive by dairy farms at this time of year or spreading it on the fields, you'll be surprised. You'd smell maybe none of that with the charcoal activated cabin filter. And if you do have that mildew odor, once you have the service done to clean out the mildew out of that box, a charcoal-activated cabin filter can cut down the odors and help with that as well.
So there you go. Well, just one other, and then we'll go to the phones. Lots of callers online. Thinking about waxing, you know, when I go to the car wash, I like to go to a car wash because they do the undercarriage. Mm-hmm. And I'll usually, I think sometimes it's a little extra for wax. I usually do the wax. Is waxing important?
It is. And the key to waxing is looking at what the paint looks like when it's wet. If the water beads up all over the place, the wax or the paint protectant, whatever it is on there, is still working. But at the point that you start to see that it isn't beaded evenly, you don't have this consistent beading of water, that's time to do something. Now, if you go to an automatic car wash, obviously it's putting on a very thin coat of wax, and that's not going to last very long. When we have rain, we think of rain as wet and kind of lubricating, but actually rain is abrasive. Rain has dust and dirt and things, particulates in it, and it'll actually, over time, driving down the highway in rain and different conditions, going to strip that wax off the car. And again, by appearance, you can see when the water doesn't bead well. But obviously the more effort it takes to put the wax on, the more effort it's going to take to take the wax off. So when you go through a car wash and it's just sort of misting a coating over the car, that's going to come off pretty quickly and easily. So you're going to need to do that on a pretty frequent basis, every week or two. If you hand wax the car, then, you know, it takes a long time to do it, but proportionally it's going to take that much longer for that to wear off the car. So
yeah, there we go. Well, we have lots of callers online. Every line's filled. Great. So let's go to Steve in Milwaukee. Thank you for waiting, Steve. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jim, Larry.
Hi, Steve.
I had an incident happen last December in which I got my car undercoated or touch-up undercoated. And then I took the car in a couple weeks later to get the inspection for winter. And, of course, I always ask them to check the fluid lines and everything. Everything was fine. The following day, my brakes completely went in heavy traffic. I like to be around. And I took it back to the mechanic, and he said, well, they couldn't see any problem with the brake lines, which was the problem. They had rusted through because of the undercoating. So I began to question whether undercoating is really a good idea, and so I have three questions for you, Jim. I heard that modern cars are so rust-resistant now that they don't need undercoating. I'm not sure if a 97 Olds would come under that category of a modern car. And the second question is, the two cars before this, I tend to keep my cars till the wheels fall off, but long before the wheels fell off, they rusted from the bottom up. So I'm just, I understand that car washes have underbody flushes, and I got that done regularly, but I understand that they really don't get into the nooks and crannies to get the salt and debris out of there. And my final question is, if I discontinue the undercoating, how do I really get clean under there? Do I buy a couple of these portable drive-on ramps and use a pressure washer, or how do you really get clean underneath?
Yeah, good questions. And this is a, you know, that exact scenario. And again, I'm glad you are still with us, Steve. That scenario is a case that a few years ago, some states have mandatory vehicle inspections, safety inspections. Wisconsin does not. But for every vehicle, once a year they have to have this. And the shops get certified to do those inspections. And on the East Coast, it was a shop that did an inspection. And a customer a couple weeks later had an incident like yours. And unfortunately, they were not so lucky. They didn't survive. And that shop got in trouble, and a technician that works on a car like that is actually personally criminally liable in a situation like that. But it's very controversial, because if you work in this field, you realize if you look under a car, there are brake lines and fuel lines that go front to rear, but they're not just exposed under the car; they're under a plastic cover to try to help protect them. And in Wisconsin, that plastic cover obviously can collect little salt chunks and all kinds of dirt and things and pack it up in there. And there's no regular maintenance procedure to take those covers down. Again, we live in Wisconsin; that plastic gets brittle. You're not likely to, after you know a handful of years, to be able to take that off and put it back on without wrecking a bunch of little pieces. And so that. You know, it is a real concern. It obviously doesn't happen to most vehicles. But question one, is it needed? Most manufacturers will say, and it is true, that undercoating from the factory is much better than it used to be. If I think back to when I started in this field, 70s, 80s, vehicles rusted out, particularly a lot of import vehicles, but domestic as well rusted out in just a few years. And so a lot of dealerships began applying undercoating, and manufacturers began to say, well, these undercoatings may not be compatible with ours. You know, more and more over the years, I've come to the conclusion that if an engineer is going to design a car for this climate, you should have to stand on a University Avenue bus stop for a slushy day and have that stuff splash up at them. And then after that day, go back and design the things and tell me that you think it's going to hold up to a Wisconsin winter. But, you know, it is a harsh, harsh climate. And in terms of the underflushing, you know, again, when I don't know that anything is actually going to get into all of those nooks and crannies. People behind me, when I go through an automatic car wash, I think get really impatient because I might take 5 minutes to go into the door where that underflush is, because that's to me, that's the most important thing. Yeah, you know, that's what I'm really in there for. I don't, you know, you can put the rest of those coatings on. They're not going to last 2 weeks, but I this time of year especially. And, you know, even better, yeah, get underneath there and rinse and rinse and rinse that, those areas out. You know, that's really the best thing to do. In terms of whether you should discontinue the rust proofing, you probably have warranties, but honestly, the rust proofing is typically not designed and sprayed on brake lines and fuel lines that go front to rear. It's sprayed on the frame of the car. There's a lot of components down there that are not sprayed, that are not supposed to be sprayed. It's for the frame of the car that they're doing that spray. You know, so that the frame itself is probably in great shape, but you know, your experience is one of the unfortunate, you know, and scary things that can happen to a car over time in this climate.
And Steve, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from John in Appleton. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry and Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is about the necessity, Jim's opinion about the necessity of leaving on a fibery, salty layer that is under a new used car that I just got, a Hyundai. Usually my kids and I change the oil on our multiple cars, and we never have had a car with this layer under it. So the Toyotas and Hondas didn't have that. You can just get right at the oil drain plug and the oil filter, take care of it underneath and above. So this car, we got it up on the ramps and figured out, oh, well, we got to take this mat off, and there are, whatever, 10 bolts or something that hold it in that tend to be sort of bound up and are a mess. And so I put lithium grease on all of them to stick them back in, and they went in okay. But I asked my local mechanic. He said some of those mats are more decorative than functional, and that other ones are made to try to protect the undercarriage from a thrown stone or whatever that could go through your oil pan. So I didn't know if Jim has any opinion about whether putting that back in place after the next oil change is a good idea, or it's not so much of a functional.
Well, it can help protect some components under the car. I mean, although I have seen plenty of people eventually give up on those things, they're often attached at the front, right at the back edge of the front bumper, which the vulnerability there is that so often when we park in a place where there's a curb that the front of the car pulls over, you pull up and you hear that scrape as the front bumper kind of slides onto the cement. And, you know, these are typically plastic retainer clips that hold them on, and a lot of times they'll get loose. Those things will come loose, and people get frustrated, and often they'll have them fixed and put back in place or replaced if they're that damaged. But a lot of times people just get frustrated and take them off. And over the years, I really haven't seen an appreciable difference for how much wear there is under the hood and you know, what really occurs to those cars that don't have them as compared to cars that keep them on and keep them in place. There are other purposes for them. Manufacturers put their cars, whether designing them, into wind tunnels and test drag coefficient. And believe it or not, you know, it is a marginal thing, but it does make a difference on drag coefficient as well. So you take that out of there, say goodbye to 0.2 miles a gallon or something. Okay, it may not seem like a big deal, but over the life of the car and over the life of 100 cars and over the life of 1,000 cars and 1,000,000 cars, that's a lot of gas. So, you know, there are little reasons that they put them there, but they can, in a number of different circumstances, like trying to change your own oil when you're not doing it on a lift, and when you go over those parking curves and the things come loose on you, they can create some real frustrations. They're a good idea that is, I could probably say, just not as well executed as it could be.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the maintenance of your vehicle today with our guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. Great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller. There's one open line at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And I believe John in Glendale up next. John, hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jim. I had a question about nanotechnology paint protection. Is that something to look into, and would it be better to have it done professionally if it is?
It, you know, they're typically, traditionally, paint has been protected with wax, with a car wax. But over the years, synthetic waxes and finishes like this, or protections like this, nanotechnology, which is considered to be kind of a ceramic finish, do stay on the paint longer. They do bind to the paint better. They do protect it longer. If I remember when I was younger and had more time spending a weekend Saturday in a park somewhere, you know, somewhere with my car and hand waxing it. And as beautiful as that looks, and it will look better than this nanotechnology or than synthetic wax, it's also not going to stay on as well. It comes off quicker. If you're going to go to a car show, that's the best finish you're going to have. But for most people, it's more practical to use synthetic waxes or just go to the car wash and get the light coating. The nanotechnology does last longer than either, you know, most traditional synthetic waxes or regular wax. So it really comes down to, you know, and it typically is not a do-it-yourself kind of thing. It's typically something that you're going to have applied by someone and buffed on and get the right finish on it. But, you know, it is superior protection for paint and will last longer than other protections you can put on it.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call, John. You can join in 800-642-1234. Give a call. Mitch in Verona, it's your turn now. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
For a Japanese car like a Camry or an Acura sold in the last 10 years, when should the transmission and the differential be flushed and or serviced? Because when you bring these cars in for routine service these days, they seem to do more of a minimalist job than they used to.
And that is the manufacturer's idea. When I look at maintenance on cars and I go back to when I started in this business, I mean, there was so much more. I mean, we have sealed wheel bearings now. You used to repack your wheel bearings every 30,000 miles. It used to be, you know, there are synthetic fluids for most of the systems on the vehicle that, you know, many of them, they say they're lifetime. And again, I would invite a engineer that designs this stuff to come and spend that day on University Avenue while slush splashes up from buses and then redesign these things. I really don't believe there's any such thing as a lifetime fluid, although manufacturers will say it. And they don't necessarily believe that either. What they say is inspect the fluid and make a determination of whether it needs to be replaced or not. You know, increasingly, there isn't just a simple visual inspection that you can do. You know, and in most shops, and my shop included, don't take that fluid and send it out to a lab somewhere for analysis to find out how much abrasives and what chemicals are in it. If it's world spec fluid, it theoretically will last the life of the car unless you tow. Generally, if you tow and put a heavier load on the drivetrain, then they're going to recommend that you flush that fluid. And depending, you said going back 10 years, most vehicles in the last 10 years are going to be world spec fluid. And if you tow, the different manufacturers will have different intervals, but it'll be somewhere in the range of 30,000 miles or 60,000 miles that they'll recommend flushing that fluid out if you tow. But, you think about it, we all drive differently. Some people drive very aggressively, and although they may never put a trailer hitch on their car, frankly, you got to think about a roof rack. If you put a roof rack on the car and put a big cargo carrier on top, you're also creating a real drag on the drivetrain, just about like towing. So that also is a consideration for thinking about changing those fluids. But if you're also a very aggressive driver and just...
Yeah.
There's not a delicate way to put this, but sometimes it's fun to beat a car, and some of us sometimes do. And if you do, you got to consider that's as hard on it as towing or having that roof rack on top. So if any of those factors apply to you, flushing a transmission fluid, particularly with synthetic fluid, is not a cheap day. You're talking about something in the range of $300, a little more, a little less. But if you plan to keep your car for a long time and you fall into one of those driving categories, then you should consider doing it at the interval that the manufacturer says you'd use for towing.
And thanks very much, Mitch, for calling. Let's take another call. Steve in Manitowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have is I'm due for some new tires. My car calls for a 215-45ZR17 in the door jamb of the car. A lot of the places in town won't put anything but that on, but there is a place that said they could put a lower rated V speed rating on the tire on. I'm just wondering, some places say they have a legally, they can't, because if you get an accident and you hurt somebody, they can come back and sue you and the company that put the tire on. And I just was wondering what I should do in that case.
It is true that more and more legal concerns determine what we do and don't do on cars. The speed rating is typically a pretty high rating in cars. The speed rating for most cars is much faster than any of us are going to drive. But I think back to the first time I said that about 5 years ago was before Wisconsin increased the speed limit on interstates to 70, and seemed like instantaneously my commute to work, which is not on an interstate, suddenly became 70 miles an hour a lot of times too. And then yet sometimes when you're driving that speed, people will pass you just screaming.
Like you're standing still.
There's certainly, if I am a tire shop, I don't know who is that guy that's really going to be the typical driver that probably is never going to exceed 75, 80 miles an hour. And who's that guy that every now and then is just, I got to get there and he's going down the interstate at 100 miles an hour plus. So I don't blame shops for saying, I can really only put on the tire that has the spec. But again, if we go back a handful of years, most shops would put on a different speed rating tire because the speed ratings typically are a very high speed for most, for each rating, higher, faster than most people are going to drive. If you can, I don't think personally that you're likely to be in danger if you have that different speed rating put on the car. But, those are the reasons that shops will shy away from that.
And thanks a lot for calling. So thinking about tires, noise in tires is interesting. If you're on the interstate, if I'm on the interstate and I'm going 70 miles an hour and then I've got the radio on and then we get to a town where I slow down and I'm going 25 miles an hour through town, suddenly I have to turn the volume down on the radio and realizing, those tires are kind of noisy. Or is it the tires?
Well, it's probably tires that you're hearing. I mean, there are things, tire noise in a wheel bearing that's starting to wear can sound pretty similar, but typically tire noise, all tires have some noise. Some manufacturers and a given set of tires, I remember having a fairly new car that we were convinced had a bad transmission, and it turned out it had just an odd set of tires. That brand of tires, we hadn't seen that issue with before. I'm not going to name the brand because it was just an anomaly that they were just extremely noisy. Tires can get noisy, though, for various reasons. On a front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive vehicles, they should be rotated about every 5,000 miles. Mm-hmm. Those rotation intervals used to be longer. They used to be closer to 7,500, but somewhere in that interval, if they're not rotated, particularly most vehicles, if they're all-wheel drive even, they're 95% front-wheel drive. That rear-wheel drive system typically only kicks in if it starts to see a wheel slip. So if you those drive axle wheels tend to wear at a faster rate than the non-drive axle wheels, and if you don't rotate them, those non-drive axle wheels have conditions of the tread that is what we call cupping, where it starts mm-hmm. to scallop. If you yeah. run your hands over the tread, it's kind of like a fish scale thing. It's smooth one way, and you can mm-hmm. feel the front edge the other way. That creates noise. And so there are conditions. Tires can just do that spontaneously. They can be that way right out of the box, and it can be created by not rotating tires frequently enough. A noisy tire doesn't necessarily mean it's a failed tire or a tire that needs attention, but if you have a noisy tire, you should have it inspected to make sure that it is safe and there isn't something that's starting to come apart or a concern with the tread. And secondly, you should have it inspected to make sure that it isn't something like a wheel bearing that's starting to go that actually sounds like a tire, because those are very difficult even for a trained tech to tell the difference. So if it's a front bearing, you know, usually if you slalom the car a little bit back and forth in the lane, the noise will be louder one way and quieter the other. Yeah. But that really wouldn't apply to a rear bearing. If four-wheel drive trucks with double bearings, it's not going to apply to those either. But on a lot of vehicles, that would be one way you could differentiate between a wheel bearing noise and a tire noise. The tire noise isn't going to change when you slalom the steering a bit.
As long as we're on tires, we were going to talk about inflating tires, and do we do it right? Or you know,
a lot of people will make a mistake, and a common mistake is that every tire will have in the printing on the side, it'll have the maximum pressure for that tire, but the manufacturer of that tire doesn't know what that tire is going on when they make that maximum pressure. So on a lot of vehicles, it'll say like 45 pounds, but that for most vehicles that would be extremely high, dangerously too high. So where you want to look is on the driver's door jamb. There's a placard that will tell you the size of tire that should be on your car, and it'll tell you the inflation that your tire should be, and that is where you should inflate them. In this climate, in the wintertime, most manufacturers will have a chart for shops that will say and show, depending on what you anticipate the temperatures, the ambient outside temperatures are going to be from now, the day you're servicing the car, to the next time you see that car, that if it's going to be so cold that you should increase that pressure. And there's a chart, depending on how cold it's going to be, it might be 2 or 3 pounds typically that you increase over what the manufacturer's spec is, just for the anticipated cold and seasonal yeah. loss of pressure. But those guidelines, people should be able to check their own tire pressures. But again, the seeing the number on the sidewall of the tire is probably the biggest error people make and think that's the right number.
Let's take a call from Rick in South Range next. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've got an age-old question about how often I should change my oil. My Toyota manual says if I use synthetic oil, something the viscosity of water up to 20, I can go 10,000 miles. I can't find very many oil change shops or even the Toyota dealership that agrees with that. What are your thoughts on this?
I want to agree with it. Really badly I do, because there's a need to use less petroleum products. I see many vehicles that does fine with. But then since those 10,000-mile intervals have been out, and for various manufacturers, some of these have been over 10 years now, with synthetic oils, there are a number of things that I've noticed. A number of manufacturers have had some issues with piston ring design or other various engine design issues that have caused some oil consumption problems. And, just for the basic logic that if your car uses some oil, and hardly anyone is in the habit of checking their own oil anymore, and gas stations don't check your oil anymore. So if a vehicle develops that kind of a problem, 10,000 miles is a long time to go. You're going to develop a problem. Whereas if you change the oil more often, even if it was a 10,000 interval, if you change it at 5,000 miles, you're going to be likely to keep ahead of that oil consumption problem and keep from doing damage to the engine. So, it is... If in a perfect world where all manufacturers made perfect vehicles and they never had a problem, this is a great idea. And for most cars out there, the proportion of cars out there that have synthetic oil and have 10,000-mile intervals, they won't have a problem. But it is also true that manufacturers are making compromises to meet the regulations for fuel consumption and for petroleum use. And there are compromises made. There are vehicles that were made 10 years ago that I don't think the engineers that made them really expected them to last 500,000 miles, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 miles. But certainly modern vehicles with a 10,000-mile oil change interval with 0.20 or 0.16, very, very light synthetic oil. And now we've got direct injection coming back, which is a high-pressure injection, which means in cold winter states, you're going to have more fuel dilution in the wintertime from that. You know, there are a lot of reasons to consider changing more oil more often. Engines that use these intervals will probably still last, a couple hundred thousand miles, maybe even 300,000 miles. But I don't think any engineers or any people, that think about that mechanically are going to say, yeah, these engines are going to last just as long as the ones that went, 400,000 or 500,000 miles. So, with that in mind, if your thought is to buy a vehicle and keep it forever and, try to make that engine last as long as you can and see if you can get to that 500,000 mile mark, you're going to want to change that oil more often. And, I want to believe, I want to say manufacturers say 10,000 miles to do that. I'm probably more comfortable with 5,000 miles myself.
There you go. Rick, thank you so much. We had another email question. Christy emailed that she's getting a car that will take flex fuel. Could you talk about whether or not it's a good idea to use this or not? There's quite a difference in price, of course.
Yep, there is. And flex fuel, this is a real controversial thing. You can, it's almost like politics. They start talking to car people about flex fuel, and people are going to split be divided on two sides of it and just argue about it. Some of the drawbacks that flex fuel vehicles in cold weather still tend to have a little trouble dialing in. It'll start and it'll run, but you might have low power in cold weather during the warm-up. By and large, people that I see buy flex fuel vehicles don't use flex fuel very often at all. And, people who have bought flex fuel vehicles with the intention of just maybe using it occasionally or let's see what happens with gas prices and have tried it have had some, some not bad experiences, not failure to start, but again, low power and just maybe not the mileage that they thought they might get. So, it's an emerging technology. Every automotive technology is emerging, changing, and evolving all the time. I think we'll see improvements of it. Gas prices are starting to go on the rise again right now. If they get high enough, it's going to become very attractive to find alternatives to straight petroleum, and the technologies will improve, and the cold winter starting and stuff will get resolved. Vehicles get more sophisticated all the time with what's called alcohol density analysis. They actually, all vehicles are running almost all vehicles in Wisconsin are running some ethanol in them, at 10% at most of the pumps. And vehicles generally do very well with that. But again, it's a fairly new technology. It's still being dialed in. The more people use it, the better the technology is going to become.
Let's see. We had a question from Mo and O'Connell. He emailed to ask how to clean headlight haze. And also, is it okay to switch back and forth from synthetic to regular oil in older cars?
Headlight haze, there are kits that are made specifically to do that. Basically, they're an abrasive. The headlight lens that hazes is a plastic, bicarbonate plastic type of lens, and it the sun causes an oxidation on it. And so basically the products that you use will either, by an abrasive, sand off a thin, very thin surface, because it isn't a very thick surface that gets oxidized, but it's enough to haze the headlights and affect how bright they are at night. So the products are either an abrasive that are a very fine abrasive designed to take that off and not leave scratch marks and sanding marks on it, or they're a chemical that just breaks it down. I had read once that insect repellent would do that. And of course, I'm not going to recommend anybody do that, but I tried it and it does. The thing about that is that within 2 months, they're hazed again. That's just not the answer. So the kits that do it, my experience is also I played with those because I like to keep and drive older vehicles. I'm always driving the older vehicle. My wife gets a new one. That's just how it is. And I like it that way. I've dealt with that quite a bit. And the kits that are fairly inexpensive are fairly easy to apply, and they last a little bit longer than insect repellent. But, there are processes that involve buffers, and I don't recommend trying to use a high-speed buffer if you're not pretty competent with it to start with, because you can burn the paint off the edge of the fender of the hood around the headlight if you're not really, really careful and mass that stuff off. But just like waxing the car, the more effort that you put into what you're doing, the better in long-term the result is going to be. So the kits that involve buffing probably are going to last a lot longer. There are also products out now that are not really designed exactly for this, but I have a lot of plastic toys in the way of kayaks, canoes, that kind of thing, and they make what's called sunscreen for your gear. And really, that is part of the key here, too, is that once you get that headlight cleaned up and that lens clear again, something like that, the coating over it is going to help prevent the sun from causing that breakdown again as quickly.
And then the oil, regular oil versus synthetic, switching back and forth on an older car?
You know, keep oil in it, check the oil. I don't care what you're trying to use. And it really, it isn't going to, you know, there has been a myth out there that if you switch to synthetic oil or you switch back and forth, an engine's going to start to use oil. I don't see any evidence of that. I've never seen any evidence of that. What's important is that the car has the right weight of oil and that it's got, that it's full and has the right amount of oil and that that oil isn't dirty and that you change it frequently enough.
John in Fitchburg, we go to you next. Hi, John.
Hi, Jim.
And,
hi, Jim. Jim, a question I have is my wife drives a Prius. She got it when she bought it from a school teacher who only had it for a couple of years, and her husband said she should put winter tires on in the wintertime. We've got those winter tires now that we took off 3 or 4 years ago, and they've been in the barn for that long. My question is, if we put those back on now, will the ability of those tires to stop and when it's slippery out and that kind of thing, is there, are they going to be as good as they should be?
Well, part of the equation here is tread depth. I mean, if you know, snow tires, really truly dedicated snow tires, are a different formula of rubber that tends to stay a little softer and a little more pliable in cold weather. It is also a different tread design with different types of different types of grooves in the tread and slices vertically across the tread to help wick moisture and snow and stuff out for traction. So just like any other tire, the tread depth is a pretty important thing. You know, if they're, you know, if you're getting down the tires for a car like a Prius may start at like 9, 10, 30 seconds of an inch. The legal limit's 2/30 seconds of an inch, but that's not going to get you anywhere in the winter in Wisconsin.
No.
You know, in the fall when we're looking at tires in October, thinking about people going through the winter, even 4 and 5/30 seconds of an inch, at that point, you know, if we're not going to see them again for 6 months, by the end of winter, they're going to have pretty compromised tires. So, you know, the tread depth of those tires is critical. And age. Most tire manufacturers will say that their tires are good for about 5-6 years. And one of the concerns, the reason they say that is, again, sun exposure. Just like the headlights, the rubber on the side of the tires will break down over time. So if you look at those tires and you can see little cracks, if you look real closely and you can see little cracks in the sidewall of the tire, that is the beginning of some concern that they're, even if the tread depth is good, that maybe they're getting a little too old and it's time to think about replacing them. Because, you know, the thing about winter tires, we don't run them all year. You know, we may drive less in the winter if we have that, you know, just because conditions are sloppy and a little more dangerous driving, and people just don't tend to want to go out if they don't have to. So those tires don't tend to get as many miles put on them, and, you know, you may have them around for a few years. I think you said 5 years. So I would, you know, tread depth and look at those sidewalls, good for dry cracking, and you know, those are the evaluations for them.
All right. There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Harold in Superior next. Hi, Harold.
Yes. Good morning. I think it's morning. Yeah. I recently changed all the fluids on my drivetrain. It was a vehicle I bought a year ago, and there's all those unknowns. So I thought, okay, this way I know all the drivetrain I'm done with. But I run into this thing about in just a casual discussion. Where the mechanic, quote-unquote, said, you know, if the tranny fluid is dirty, you know, you shouldn't change it. And, you know, some people apparently even have tranny fluid that's black. But so I went online because I've heard this for 40 years. And boy, there's a lot of you know, seemingly qualified people that are saying, "Oh, if it's dirty, don't change it because you're going to mess up the protection that gears have and so on." And I'm just thinking, I've never seen an owner manual that said, "Don't change your oil if it's dirty."
Well, logic does apply here, and dirty fluid is not going to lubricate as well as clean fluid. Every now and then, when a transmission gets really dirty, or it's particularly, it isn't, when we say dirty, and it's not dirt getting in there. Transmissions get metal material from the wear of the gear and the bearings, and they get fiber material from the wear of the clutch packs. And so dirty oil means that it's got more fiber or more metal in it. And a truth is that if a vehicle has got a dirty enough and enough buildup of stuff in the transmission and it's actually started to coat and build up like a varnish on the walls of the transmission and some chunks here and there. Flushing it out can break some stuff loose and may plug up a solenoid or something somewhere. And then, you know, someone in hindsight will look at that and say, oh, man, if I hadn't done this, this never would have happened. There's no guarantee that never would have happened. That could happen to you driving 80 miles an hour down the road, down the highway, and cause you a breakdown in an inconvenient situation. So it's if that's going to happen, and it's a small, small proportion, percentage of vehicles that ever happens to. But if you're a customer or a technician that ever had that experience and you look at it and say, boy, I wish I hadn't done that. No, that's not the right way to look at it. The right way to look at it is that that was the ideal place for that to happen in the shop after they changed the fluid.
Yeah.
You know, and if I'm the consumer and say, what do you do? What did you do to my transmission? Well, the technician is fairly innocent in that situation. But again, that's a very small percentage of but that's where it comes from. That's where that myth comes from. Now, if the fluid's dirty, you're better off to change it. That is the thing to do. And you did the right thing when you buy a used vehicle and you don't know where that history is on when those things have been done. You know, you get it taken care of, and now you know, and you're more comfortable driving the vehicle.
And thanks again, Gary, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim Ward, our guest today, he's service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your vehicle today and its maintenance with our guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Number to call with a question, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Gary and Tomahawk up next. Let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Hi there, guys. Hey, I put a lot of miles on my 17 Nissan Pathfinder. We're 8,000 miles a month. And I change my oil somewhere between 4,000 to 5,000 miles with full synthetic. But I'm wondering, this has that CVC transmission, and I'm wondering about changing the fluids in that as well as like the radiator type fluids.
Sure. CVT is what they call that transmission, and most CVT transmissions don't have a fluid change interval, but they do have a fluid in them. Typically they don't have a fluid change interval because they don't work the same way. They don't have the fluid clutch pack, so they still have bearings and gears, so you still can have some metal contamination. But in most transmissions, the thing that causes a problem in the fluid is the fiber from the clutch pack. So this is a little bit different setup in that transmission. I have had customers change them, and when you put the kind of miles on that you do, this is one of those areas where, you know, there's some expense involved, but it typically is not going to do any harm to change it. And that your use at 8,000 miles a month is about as heavy as any of us are ever going to see.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to make that vehicle last. There's nothing wrong with changing those. You know, again, by and large, for the most part, for most of my career, I've said stick to manufacturer's recommendations because there are reasonable things to expect that fluids will last. And I want to believe, you know, in terms of synthetic oil and 10,000 mile use, but your situation is unique and you're putting a lot of miles on there. So, you know, you can have the fluids looked at and evaluated, and that's probably the best thing to do. It isn't done often enough. We can send fluids to a lab. It's not terribly expensive, and find out how much metal particulates are in there and how much wear that's going to cause. You know, it probably costs $40-45 to have oil analyzed that way, but given what it costs to change a fluid, that's probably a good investment.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Eric in Madison, your turn.
Hi. Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. I worked with a mechanic, and he had a oil filtration system. I forget what it was, but it took two rolls of toilet paper. You'd pop the top on it, put them rolls of toilet paper down there, and he never changed his oil. And he claimed that oil doesn't break down. It's the detergents and the additives that do. And he pulled the dipstick on his car, and I forget what he said. The last time he changed it, it was clean as like new. And he would add the additive. But if you don't have that, I think with these new synthetics, you can run it 10 or 12,000 miles, but you should change your filter every, you know, 2,500 or 3,000 miles. And you can get the longevity out of the full synthetics.
Well, I'll tell you, oil filter technology has come as far as oil technology itself. Over the years, I've seen videos of, and you can go on YouTube and see this, people will take oil filters of various brands, generic ones, the manufacturers, and cut them open and show you how much filter material there is in them. And it varies greatly, from the cheapest filter you can buy in a given parts store somewhere to the best filter that you can buy. So oil filtration is extremely important. That's absolutely true. I don't see the need with modern filters to change a filter every 2,500 miles. Again, for most people that have a synthetic oil car that calls for 10,000 miles, changing the oil and the filter at 10,000 miles is going to work great. That car is probably not, with that maintenance interval, it's probably not going to ever get 400,000 to 500,000 miles out of an engine. But I'm really not seeing where they wouldn't get, 200,000 to 300,000 miles out of them, in my experience. And again, there are a lot of other reasons to consider changing fluids more frequently. Like I was talking about earlier, vehicles, some vehicles will consume oil. You may not realize your vehicle consumes oil. Changing it more often is going to help, stay ahead of having too much lubrication loss to the point where it does engine damage. So there's a lot of logical good reasons to change it more often, but I think 2,500 miles would be more frequent than I would recommend for oil filtering. Again, filter technology has come a long way, but if you're going to buy the cheapest filter out there, then yeah, you might want to consider changing it more often, but then it kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
You might as well put a little more money into a better filter and not have to change it so frequently.
Let's go to Jude in Iola next. Thank you for calling, Jude.
Hi, my question is about my husband's 2003 Toyota Tundra pickup.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And normally, how many miles usually, like for a pickup truck? I'm basically want to know how long the transmission should last.
Well, on a Tundra, we don't see a lot of transmission failure. And most Tundras, I drive a Tundra, and mine's near the vintage that this one is. And most people that have these have them because they're able to tow, and they can tow a lot of weight. And towing a lot of weight does have an effect on the transmission. And that being said, most of the vehicles that I see, Tundras in particular, that tow, we really don't see transmission failures, under 200,000 to 300,000 miles. That's not to say we don't see some failures, but not at any higher rate than any other vehicle. Transmission problems, when we say transmission failure, that can mean a lot of different things. Most transmissions that transmission is electronically controlled transmission. So if we do a repair on a transmission, like out of an 03 Tundra, most often it's going to be that a check engine light has come on, that some of the components that help control the electronically controlled transmission may have failed, a solenoid or something. Some of those solenoids are more important than others, and their failure can cause loss of control of the hydraulic pressure and lubrication of the transmission, which can lead to transmission failure. But it's not common. An 03 Tundra, I would expect most of those to have a transmission to go 300,000 miles. But just like any other mechanical device, we're going to see failures on what's called the bell-shaped curve. Some of them are going to fail at 5,000 miles under warranty, just something, just a freak failure of some component in it, and some of them are going to go 500,000 miles and never have a failure, but we certainly see most of them go several hundred thousand.
And thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Marita in McHenry, Illinois next. Hi, Marita.
Hi, thank you. I enjoy the program. I'm a three-year widow, and I count on other people. They help me understand some things in the car. I have a three-year-old Buick Envision SUV, but I'm moving out to California, and I know their gas is astronomically high out there and going, and I'm thinking of getting a hybrid car. I'd like to get a hybrid SUV, and I'm just wondering, what do I look for? How do I know I'm getting the best buy for my money?
Sure. Well, full disclosure, I work for a Toyota dealer, and I'm very biased toward Toyota products, hybrids. But Priuses are great vehicles. You're looking at SUVs, so the Highlander and the RAV4 are both available in hybrid. But the truth of the matter is, many, many companies have gotten into the hybrid business. So and there are some very high end hybrids. So obviously the best hybrids somewhat are going to be, some fairly expensive cars. That doesn't mean that you have to buy a highline car or a luxury car. Those are going to be better cars simply because there's more put into them, and that's why they cost more. You know, the key thing that you said that sticks with me is that you know, like most of us, we're not all experts in everything, and you depend on other people for your advice on the cars. So my recommendation to you is going to be when you know, if you're going to wait to buy it to move out there, find a place where you can build some rapport. I know there was one shop I've read about called Luscious Garage, run by a woman out in California. I can't remember what city it is, but she specializes in hybrids. And you know, but that individual, if you can find a person that you feel like you can trust and you can build rapport with, what do they recommend you drive? What are they most knowledgeable about? What are they going to be able to give you the best help with, you know, in terms of maintaining and keeping up that vehicle, regardless of the brand? Again, as much as I'd like to say, oh, Toyota, really, that's really more important, is who you can build some rapport with, a shop that you can connect with, and, you know, and a vehicle they're familiar with is going to be your best bet.
So Luscious Vehicle, did you?
Luscious Garage. They don't sell vehicles. They fix vehicles. It's, you know, a woman owns it. It's just an interesting take. Look it up sometime. You know, they specialize in hybrids. But you know, I get the impression that they've got a customer base that just, you know, just adores them, and that their specialty is building rapport with customers. And you know, again, I don't think the brand is as important as, and there is a difference in brands, but again, a good shop that specializes in hybrids that you can build a rapport with is going to give you the best advice for that circumstance, for where you live, what they work on, what they see in that climate. That's what you want to go with.
There you go, Marita. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Beth in Fitchburg, hi.
I am calling. We have a check engine light that went on recently. And a friend had a code reader and read the code for us, and it said light fuel mix on idle. And I was wondering if you could explain what that means and maybe what it takes to fix that.
Can you tell me what your model of vehicle is?
It is a 2007 Hyundai Entourage.
Okay. So that code is probably something like PO171. The engine fuel mixture is controlled by a number of devices, and at idle, it's different than when you're driving and accelerating. That this could be something like an air control valve that has gotten varnished up and sticky, but there's something that is no longer allowing the fuel system to set the fuel mixture properly at idle. And, you know, that's it. A lean mixture, the engine's going to try to compensate for that and make the mixture richer, which makes the car probably use more gas than it should, which is a fail-safe, because if it runs too lean, that can do engine damage. Too rich typically just uses more fuel. But you need to have a further diagnosis, some test run to determine what fuel component isn't doing its job to help maintain the fuel mixture right.
And we will be back with Jim Ward right after this look at the news. We're taking a look at vehicle maintenance, your vehicle, here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Jim Ward, back with us once again, service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. Great to have him back. Certainly a question for him. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Some callers on the line. There's still a couple lines open, but Sherman and Bruce, it's your turn. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have a 2007 vehicle with about 130,000 miles on it, and I just had the oil changed, and they say that it's leaking oil and leaking power steering fluid. One, is it wise to just get rid of the car, or is it wise to have the engine seals repaired?
Well, you know, if you're happy with the vehicle, if it's filling your needs and it has all of the safety devices and toys that you like on it and you're comfortable driving it, I don't see any reason to replace it. I mean, ultimately, a vehicle is always going to cost us something. So, you know, when you buy a vehicle initially, you either put a lump sum of money down or you make payments on it. And I've always told my kids, when those payments are done, keep putting money away every month, because you're still going to have payments, and they're going to be things like oil leak repairs and tires and brakes. And so, you know, I've had customers of my own over the years who were people who could afford to drive anything they wanted to, but decided, I'm going to keep this one going and keep it in nice shape. I mean, I'm talking showroom shape, and have driven them 450,000 miles, not without cost. And a couple of times over those experiences over the years, you know, I've had him say to me, am I crazy doing this? Does this make sense? And so we sat down and did the math and looked at how much they paid for all of the repairs and everything they did. And yes, they paid probably 2 to 3 times what they bought the car for originally. But then we also calculated if you were making payments of $300 to $400 a month, and they were tens of thousands of dollars ahead for maintaining the car and doing the repairs on it. So again, if you're happy with the car, if it's got the safety features that you feel like you need and want, and it's got the, you know, the toys, and you know, basically if you like it and you're comfortable in that car, it is worth it in the long run in almost every case to maintain and keep a car rather than keep buying new cars.
There you go, Sherman. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Mike in Plover. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hi, Jim, too.
Hi, Mike.
I have a 2009, actually Avalon, and I have it in it a one-year-old battery. And if the car sits for 3 days without running, which it does fairly often now, the battery runs down to zero. And I took it in. I had the battery checked. That's been checked out okay. The alternator output's been checked out okay. Mm-hmm. And then a draw test was done. And they're saying it's drawing 70 milliamps.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that's a little bit high.
It is. Yeah, it is.
And they're recommending it because I do have, it's got a smart key and a remote start, aftermarket remote mm-hmm. start. And they're saying I could disconnect the remote start because that draws power. And I'd prefer not to do that, but I'm not too sure where to go from here except to try to do, you know, a drain test on it somehow.
Well, the draw test is a drain test. That's what that is. And it, you know, first of all, it's your... it may be a constant draw on that vehicle, but electrical draw is not always constant. Many times when we look at a vehicle that's experiencing what you are, when we do the draw test, the draw is normal. But that doesn't mean it's always normal. Things can malfunction intermittently, and electrical things tend to be intermittent about half the time. So it's a good thing. It's a lucky thing in a sense that it was acting up when they tested it. And again, your vehicle may have that draw constantly all the time. When we look at vehicles that have had electronics added onto them other than the factory systems, you know, particularly on an Avalon, tend to be pretty sound. So most technicians look at a vehicle like that and see, oh, okay, it's had an add-on system here for remote start. That we're almost always right, even though we may not have tested it yet, to say that's probably where it's going to be. Usually where it ends up being. So, you don't necessarily have to uninstall the whole thing, but if you disconnect the power to it, there's probably an inline fuse somewhere, you know, and either wait a few days and see if the battery doesn't discharge, or do the draw test again and find out if that draws back down in the range of 30 milliamps or under that it should be, then you know you've got it licked. I mean, you know, there a technician, the choices are either to do that kind of thing, or a technician starts pen testing, you know, with a multimeter, a voltmeter, all the way through the system, looking, trying to track down where it is. There's miles of wiring in there. So that is long-term, you know, expensive diagnostics. The preferable way, the way that we kind of, narrow it down way is if you disconnect the remote start, and that's not, is to start pulling the other fuses on it. Now you can't, some of the fuses are power systems that you need while you're driving, so you can't necessarily drive it with those fuses pulled. But if the car sits 2 or 3 days at a time, you can start systematically the fuse panel and pull number one fuse. And if over 2 or 3 days the battery doesn't discharge, something in that circuit was in, and at least you've narrowed it down. So when the technician starts testing, he doesn't have, maybe he's got a quarter mile instead of 7 miles of wiring to test. So there's different ways to go about this, but again, it is very logical. It's very normal. Most technicians are going to look at an aftermarket system like that remote start and say that's the place to start, and they are probably right.
Jeff in Rhinelander emailed. He's got a 2008 Toyota Tundra. It had a recall for the frame rusting. He went to the dealership. They put a black tar-like spray on the frame last fall, but this spring it's already chipping off, and many other owners he knows are having the same issue, as well as some rust through the holes in the bed of the pickup just behind the wheel well.
Yeah, a couple of different issues that are going on. I mean, the frames, that vehicle did have a frame issue. Toyota did come out with not a recall, but a customer support program to either replace the frame if it had perforations that were like 10 millimeters or larger. And if it didn't, then they put a corrosion-resistant compound on it. That corrosion-resistant compound was one of the reasons that I suggested engineers who design things for automobiles spend a day standing on University Avenue and it's slushy out and buses are going by, because that is a very frustrating thing. I drive one of those as well. Same experience, although I didn't put that coating on mine because I work on it myself, and that coating never really sets up. And if you get under your vehicle and work on it, you're going to be black, tarry stuff up to your elbows every time. It does clean up very easily, though. It comes off pretty easily with simple green. It was an idea that looked good on paper. Is my opinion on it. It is the corrosion-resistant compound, if it stays on the frame, does help slow corrosion. It's not going to stop it. A frame that's rusting is eventually going to rust out. The situation with the bed is different. It's not related to the same thing of the rust coming up through, and they also had a bulletin on that and had an updated bed, but on a 2008, that's something that's not going to have coverage anymore, unfortunately. That vehicle's at an age where I don't think there's going to be anything that's going to cover that bed. I would check with the Toyota dealer on the bed, though, and just see where you're at in terms of what the coverage was there. But I think it's going to have been expired on a 2008.
Oh, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see. We've got Richard in Madison with a question. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a Toyota that I bought from Smart in January 2 years ago. I guess it's a 2017 model. But anyway, this is weird. I don't think it's my imagination. Sometimes when I start the car up, I don't get the data on the middle of the dashboard, mileage and all that sort of thing. Then maybe the next time, well, it's just blank. It's like a blank slate. The next time, maybe I start the car, and there is all the usual data.
That's interesting. Yeah,
some reason we got intermittent display there. Well, I off the top of my head, I can't recall a bulletin that specifically addresses that. But have you, you've taken it in and had inquired about it, or we've checked it out for you?
I'm doing this, and not to have to take it in. But
I would suggest making that call, because the first thing I'm going to do is check that this could well be a known issue that they have a specific repair bulletin for. It sounds kind of familiar, but there's so many of those bulletins I can't memorize them anymore. Don't necessarily know. It certainly isn't normal. I mean, it should work the same way every time. There's something going on there. So there's either a loose connection somewhere to that display, or there's some kind of a known software update or something that needs to be done, but certainly not a normal condition. So, yep, give us a call at the dealership and we can take a look into this a little deeper and find out just what might be going on there.
All right. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Mai in Appleton, your turn now. Hi, Mai.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call. I am driving a 2010 Corolla Toyota.
Okay.
And last couple of weeks, when I experienced some slippery on the street and the engine light was on, and also the sign that tell you it's slippery, and there's a button push the side that's slippery. I pushed it. It didn't go off until the end of the day. And then it went off later on. And then the following week, the same way, but it went off by itself. So my question is, should I be concerned?
Well, something... The computer that runs the engine and the transmission saw something it felt was a malfunction. That's what turned the light on. But and there's lots of fluky things that can happen in cars, and we drive them in all kinds of conditions. We're driving these vehicles around in slushy, wet winter conditions. So it's possible that it just saw a fluke and saw it a couple times in real slushy, wet, slippery conditions and registered it as a fault and turned your light on. And then later the computer, it rechecks for that every time you start up the car. At some point it decided that this was resolved or it never really was a problem. The light didn't stay on. So if the light's currently off, the computer's satisfied that everything's working properly. But electrical problems on cars tend to be intermittent about 50% of the time. So you might not see that light come on again at all. You may. The one thing that we do know is that if the light was on, there are likely to be some codes stored that at least say what system turned it on. They're not necessarily going to give a complete diagnosis, but you can... you could have it scanned to find out what those codes are. And a lot of places will do that at a minimal or no cost, just to tell you the code and what system turned it on. But, you know, I wouldn't worry about it that much. I suspect that it was just a fluke condition, and the conditions you were driving in, if it doesn't come back on, I wouldn't worry about it. If it does come back on, I would have it checked out. The check engine light's got two modes it can be in. It can be on solid, which is registering a problem, or it can be flashing. If that light's flashing, that's time to pull over as soon as you can safely and have the car towed. If it's on solid, that means the computer has fail-safe circuits that it can continue to safely operate the car until you can get it in, get it diagnosed, and get it fixed. So the light itself being on doesn't mean that the car is unsafe to drive, but yeah, so the choice is already to go have the codes checked now. They're not really going to be able to do an accurate diagnosis now because the condition's clearly not acting up. That's why the computer turned the light off. Or to wait, see if it comes back on again. And if it comes back on again, I'm going to recommend getting it in as soon as possible after that, because, again, we already know it's potentially intermittent. And if you see the light come on and wait too many days, you may come in and the condition may not be active at that point. They may not be able to make diagnostic headway with it.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Brenda emailed to ask what mileage a timing belt should be changed on a Kia Soul.
Well, you know, it's funny. Today we've been talking a lot about fluids and varying intervals from what the manufacturers say. I don't know what the Kia's interval is for it, but you could look that up online. You can look in your maintenance manual. But timing belts are the kind of thing that should be changed very specifically at the manufacturer's interval. You don't want to take a chance of going longer. You know, you can potentially do engine damage. Some engines are interference. Some engines aren't. That means that when the timing belt or change breaks, the engine can do damage. I'm not sure on the Kia if it's interference or not. Usually engines that are interference have chains, but yep, don't want to mess around with timing chains and running them longer than the manufacturers recommend. Most manufacturers are going to say somewhere in the range of 90 to 100,000 miles, but I would investigate what Kia says and change it at the interval.
Let's go to Rose in Menominee Falls next. Hi, Rose.
Oh, hello. I have a 2011 Toyota Yaris sedan, and the hubcaps keep falling off. And I've lost several, and I've replaced them. I've gone online and purchased them. And when the last time it happened, when I replaced my tires, I asked the tire dealership why that was. And he suggested that I needed specific real Toyota hubcaps, not knockoffs. So I went to my dealership for its normal service, and I bit the bullet and purchased the Toyota hubcap, which is incredibly more expensive.
Mm. Yeah.
And I got home, and that hubcap is still on there. I got home, and within 2 days, another of my other hubcaps fell off. And I'm not aware that they fall off even when I'm driving. So what's the deal with that?
And that's not a Toyota hubcap that fell off.
Or did you buy a whole set and they're all Toyota now?
No, I just replaced one, okay. And the one that fell off again was a knockoff one.
Well, yep, there are no bolts or screws or anything that hold their hubcaps on. They're held on by spring pressure. If you look at the inside of the hubcap, the outside is what it's supposed to look pretty looking at the wheel, but if you look at the inside, there's really just a wire, what we call a bale type retainer. It's a tensioned wire that just catches a lip on the outside of the hubcap. And if you look at that and you look at the design, think about it for a minute, it's more of a wonder that they stay on than they don't. I think about some of the roads that I've had to drive on the last few months, the way Wisconsin has been this winter. And man, there are areas on my regular drive where I would drive in the other lane. Across the center line, but just there's a right and left lane. Just I'd normally be in the right lane because I turn right in a quarter mile. I'd drive in the left lane right up to the turn because there were so many potholes. So, you know, the road condition when they're really rough and we're hitting potholes can cause wheel covers to come off. Some damage to a wheel, if you've rubbed up against a curb or hit a pothole hard enough, that little groove that the little retainer spring's supposed to catch on the wheel can be compromised enough that maybe it can't hold it on. And certainly it's true that when you buy generic wheel covers, they're made to fit all kinds of cars. So there's going to be a range of fit. The original factory ones will generally fit better. But, you know, at this point, one other thing to consider is if you can get original factory factory wheels, wheel covers and hubcaps used as well. I don't know if they're still around. There used to be a company in Dane County called Hubcap Nelly, and they basically, you know, I don't know if they drive around just collecting the ones, you know, they see on the edge of the road, or if they, but you know, it's a lot less expensive. That's another option. You know, I'd love to have you come on into a Toyota dealership and buy new ones, but honestly, you know, it's an appearance only cosmetic thing. It really doesn't serve another function on the car, but they do look better with them on. So, you know, I would replace them with the original factory ones, but you might want to look into used. There's salvage yards and hubcap specialty places that you can get the factory ones secondhand and not have to pay quite as much.
And there you go. Thank you so much for calling, Rose. Let's go to Chris in Kewaunee next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. Here's my issue. I have a 06 Toyota Highlander hybrid. Driving short distances, less than an hour, I have absolutely no issues. When I'm on long trips, hour and a half to 3 hours, all the hybrid lights come on, traction control lights come on. And I've taken it to two dealers, and they can't seem to find what's wrong. I wondered if you had any thoughts.
I guess when you took it to those dealers, were the lights on at that time?
No.
Yeah, and that's going to be the key.
At the time. Now I've learned that if I just take the negative cable off for 15 seconds and reapply it, it resets. Sure. But when those original issues happened, they were on.
And again, I'm sure when it's happening, you're on a trip. You're probably on vacation. There's no time more precious than that. And who wants to go to a shop and spend some time having a look at a car if it's seeming to work right otherwise? You know, the thing is, when they looked at it, there were probably codes they can see, but the condition wasn't active. And you can't reset the check engine light simply by taking the negative battery cable off if it is not already resolved. That will reset the system, but if the condition were a hard set condition that were still present when you connected it back up and went through a couple of drive cycles, it would come right back on. So when we try to reset a check engine light through the OBD connector with a scan tool, or when you do it by taking that negative cable off, you're making a request. The computer may or may not grant that request and turn the light off if the condition is still present. And that's the key here, is that the condition's not present, and that's why it isn't diagnosable. So the best bet is to get the car in the condition where you've driven it that long distance, those lights are on, and as quickly as possible after those lights are on is when that testing needs to be done to try to get to the bottom of what's actually turning them on and causing this.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim in Wisconsin Rapids, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You touched on it a little bit a while back, but my daughter has a 2004 Dodge Stratus, and the timing belt broke on her. And the repair, we've been told, is quite costly, the estimate. And the car isn't worth a whole lot more than the repair. And it goes into that non-interference and interference engine situation, and mm-hmm. they said even if they do repair it, there's no guarantee. I guess bells can break, bend, and things right. that, like you said. Is that pretty much where we're at with that? We're thinking we'll even get it repaired.
It's sure sounding like it. I mean, in a situation like that, you may be better off looking for a used engine if you're really thinking about keeping the car at all. You know, unfortunately, with the engine in the shape it's in, it's not worth much as a trade or to do anything else with. And, you know, but yeah, that unfortunately is what can happen, is that the upper and lower half of the engines are timed precisely by that timing belt. If it fails, they're not timed anymore. And the pistons and valves, which normally should be able to come very close to each other, suddenly kiss. And when they do, it is catastrophic. It's going to do it typically can destroy the engine. And it is, you know, unfortunately, they can't really know the extent of the damage without tearing it down. You're investing a lot of money to tear it down. It probably isn't worth it to do that tear down. So if you really wanted to keep the car, you'd probably be looking at a replacement used engine or just think about replacing the car completely.
Patricia emailed and wonders, you know, the outside temperature sensor is located in a car. Where is it located in a car? And why isn't it affected by sun, road heat, and so forth?
Well, it is affected by road heat, but it is located up, usually on most cars, it's located up in the front of the car, up just behind the front bumper, not too near the radiator, because obviously the radiator gets hot, and the heat from that, they don't want affecting it. But, you know, typically in most vehicles I've seen, it's a little offset to the driver's side, up tucked in up behind the front bumper. But, they are affected by heat. If you're in a big shopping mall's parking lot for hours and come out in the middle of a very hot day, you may get a pretty high reading at first, but they typically correct within a couple of minutes of driving to what the actual ambient temperature is.
Would you consider an extended warranty if you drive a Volkswagen Golf 40,000 miles a year?
You know, some people will buy extended warranties on every product they buy. I am not that guy. I will tear apart a refrigerator, a dehumidifier. I will tear apart a radio, a TV, vehicles. That's just who I am. And so I look at those contracts and I say, no. It's insurance. The truth is it's insurance. And what is the truth about most insurance? Most people aren't going to use it. That's how insurance companies make money. But if you're not able to fix those things yourself, you're probably going to sleep better if you buy it.
All right. On that note, Jim, you're back on June 20th, and we'll do this all over
again.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Toyota in Madison. He does a great job, doesn't he? He'll be back on June 20th. We'll do it again. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Liz Freemuth will be on to talk about perennial flowers. That's at 11 tomorrow and Saturday morning at 6. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. Grrrr!